or ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the New York State Department of Health has declared Eastern equine encephalitis an imminent threat to public health. That's after an Ulster County resident died of the virus yesterday. We'll have the latest on what you need to know to protect yourself from the virus. Democrats are losing ground in Pennsylvania voter registrations. The party's advantage over Republicans is slimmer than at any point since 1998. We chat with Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA about why Democrats' overall share of voters is declining. More than maps, we'll get insights from the New York New Jersey Trail Conference from Brett Berry of the Cats Cast podcast, and moving toward health with Maggie Fitzpatrick, the health and wellness columnist for the Democrat. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United Nations General Assembly has convened its latest session in New York this morning. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke first to delegates. He says world conflicts and problems are creating a threat to humanity.
Geopolitical divisions keep deepening. The planet keeps heating. Wars rage with no clue how they will end. And nuclear posturing and new weapons cast a dark shadow. We are edging towards the unimaginable, a power keg that risks engulfing the world.
President Biden is scheduled to address the UN this morning. Israeli forces and Hezbollah militants based in Lebanon continue to trade fire. The Lebanese health ministry says 2 days of Israeli airstrikes have killed 558 people in Lebanon. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
Israel carried out more than 1,300 airstrikes on Monday, followed by several more overnight, mostly in southern Lebanon. It said the airstrikes took out Hezbollah munitions, including long-range cruise missiles aimed at Israel. In just one day, those strikes killed almost 500 people in Lebanon, including at least 35 children, according to Lebanese health officials. More than 1,600 were wounded. Hezbollah in turn barraged Israel with more than 250 rockets shot deeper into the country than it has in almost a year of conflict. Most were intercepted mid-air, although some damage was reported, including at a regional hospital in northern Israel. Meanwhile, Israel has continued to issue warnings urging civilians in southern Lebanon to flee, saying it has not ruled out a possible ground invasion into Lebanese territory. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The National Hurricane Center has issued a hurricane watch for parts of Florida's Gulf Coast. That section includes Tampa. The storm system is moving into the Gulf of Mexico and, by tomorrow, could be named Hurricane Helene. Forecasters warn the storm could become a major hurricane before landfall. Stocks opened mixed this morning as China announced new steps to rev up the world's second-largest economy. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped about 8 points in early trading.
China's central bank announced broad new measures designed to encourage bank lending and property purchases. That includes lowering the reserves that banks are required to hold, as well as the down payment required of people buying second homes. Financial markets cheered the move. Stock indexes in both Hong Kong and Shanghai jumped more than 4%. Elsewhere in Asia, stocks also gained ground overnight in Tokyo and Seoul. Stock in Deere & Company is still looking green, despite former President Donald Trump's threat to slap big tariffs on the tractor maker. Trump is unhappy with Deere's plans, announced in June, to shift some manufacturing to Mexico. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down more than 20 points. This is NPR. A Senate committee is scheduled to hear about the high cost of weight loss drugs manufactured by drug maker Novo Nordisk. They include Ozempic and Wegovy. The company's CEO, Lars Jorgensen, is scheduled to testify. In a written statement, he said his company has spent billions of dollars on diabetes and obesity research. The Senate committee has released a report saying that the cost of Wegovy is less in European nations. Aircraft maker Boeing has sweetened its contract offer to its striking machinists. NPR's Joel Rose reports the proposal comes in the second week of a strike.
Boeing is offering a 30% raise over 4 years in what it calls its best and final offer to the machinists union. The Seattle area workers who assemble Boeing's best-selling commercial planes have been on strike since September 13th. They rejected an earlier contract proposal that would have raised wages by 25%. Boeing's latest proposal would reinstate a performance bonus, improve retirement benefits, and double the ratification bonus to $6,000 if workers accept by Friday. Boeing has already frozen hiring and started furloughs for thousands of U.S. employees. A prolonged strike could cost billions of dollars, putting a further strain on the company's finances. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
A former executive from the collapsed cryptocurrency exchange FTX will be sentenced in federal court today in New York. Caroline Ellison pleaded guilty to fraud charges, and she turned prosecution witness against her former boyfriend and FTX founder, Sam Bankman-Fried. He was convicted and sentenced to 25 years in prison. Ellison is asking for leniency. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Yesterday, we told you about an Ulster County resident infected with the Eastern Equine Encephalitis virus. That person has died, according to the New York Department of Health. The patient, who has not been identified, marks New York's first human case of Triple E since 2015. Triple E is a rare but serious mosquito-borne virus that is fatal in roughly one-third of the people who develop severe symptoms. Jason Dole spoke to Lana Bellamy from the Times Union for more details.
We just learned about the first case in the state, which officials said was an Ulster County resident who was hospitalized on Friday on September 20th. And so a lot of people who maybe didn't even see that on Friday saw that this morning. And then this afternoon, the governor came out and with a press release announcing that this person has reportedly died because of contracting the Eastern Equine Encephalitis virus. We don't really know much more about the person.
Right, of course.
But the state is taking a lot of steps right now to try to prevent, further infection.
Yeah, so now that it's actually officially announced as a threat to public health, what does that open up for the state to do?
Yeah, so making this declaration, it should free up some state resources for local health departments to take more preventive measures to sort of control the mosquito population, for instance, with spraying. To kill mosquitoes. But beyond that, the health department is also urging people to do what they can to protect themselves too, which would involve, wearing long sleeves and pants and, getting rid of standing water near your home and wearing mosquito repellent. And what this declaration is also going to do too is the state has already been expanding access to mosquito repellent at certain parks and state sites. And so they're also, in addition to that, trying to increase public awareness. So they're putting up signs at all of these places, even popular Hudson Valley trailheads, and, providing some more protection for people so that they can be aware of the risk.
This is where I just want to remind the listener that even though it is called Eastern Equine Encephalitis and that, it is found in horses, the way that people contract it, and this is why we're talking about mosquito and mitigating risk against mosquito bites, is because that's how it's transmitted from horses to people. I guess this is around from time to time, from year to year. What's different about this year with this Eastern Equine Encephalitis that it's so prominent in our news?
Yes, that's a good question. The state health commissioner, Dr. James McDonald, today, he made that note in a statement that this year is different. And it appears that it's different mostly in just the prevalence of it. In his statement, he said, normally mosquitoes carrying EEE, as it's referred to, maybe they come up in two or three counties each year. But this year, officials have already found these mosquitoes with this virus in 15 counties. So it just seems to be a lot more present.
A lot more present, a lot more widespread. Your article also notes that it's found in other areas too. Massachusetts, Vermont, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Wisconsin, and New Hampshire also reporting EEE cases this year. So this is pretty serious. Can we talk a little bit about who's at risk and what are some of the symptoms?
Yeah, sure. So the state health department has been trying to put out a lot of this information because maybe people haven't even heard of this before. I honestly hadn't heard of it until this year because it's been so prominent in the news. And so I've learned that, for instance, anyone of any age can get this infection, but people who are older than 50 and younger than 15 are at a particularly high risk for acquiring the virus if they're bit by a mosquito that's carrying it. There's not a vaccine commercially available for it. So, you know, that's just another reason to try anything you can to keep from getting mosquito bites right now. Most people who are bitten by an infected mosquito, they might not develop symptoms. And severe cases may begin with a sudden headache or a high fever, chills, and vomiting. And it could take a couple days for it to sort of incubate. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But you may see the illness progressing into disorientation, seizures, encephalitis, and a coma. So not everyone develops such severe symptoms, but about a third of people who develop the, you know, encephalitis, they die. And many people may survive it, but still experience neurologic impairment.
So this is very serious, and the more we look at it, it gets even more serious, and there's so little that can be done for it. That's why officials are recommending just avoid getting bit by the mosquitoes. I am going to go over all of the precautions that officials are outlining in detail. But first, Lana, I want to thank you for your reporting and for taking the time to talk to us about it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The full list of recommended precautions to reduce the risk of infection from EEE and other mosquito-borne illnesses from the state health department. First up is consider wearing long sleeves and then tucking your pants into your socks or your shirt into your pants when outdoors at dusk or dawn, the time of day when mosquitoes are most active. Use insect repellents containing DEET. Be sure to follow the insect repellent label directions. Children should not handle repellents directly. Instead, adults should apply repellents to their hands first, gently spread them on the child's exposed skin. And another recommendation is make sure there are screens in the windows and doors of your home. Make sure the screens are free of rips, tears, and holes. And eliminate all standing water in yards around the home and property. This is where mosquitoes can breed, and it includes plastic containers, pool covers, wading pools, ceramic pots, clogged drain pipes, and wheelbarrows. Also, it's recommended that you change water in any bird baths twice a week. And finally, on this story, one last item is this afternoon, Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger released the following statement on this story, quote, I have been informed by county and state health department officials that an Ulster County resident who contracted Eastern Equine Encephalitis EEE has regretfully passed away. I extend my sincere condolences to the patient's family and loved ones. This is the first human case of EEE in New York since 2015, and the Ulster County Health Department is working closely with New York State and other partners to monitor the situation and keep the public informed of any additional cases. I urge Ulster County residents to take all precautions and avoid mosquito bites, including by using repellent, wearing long sleeves and long pants, and avoiding outdoor activity at dawn and dusk. End quote from Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger.
And that's Jason Dole with that update on the Ulster County resident who died of Eastern equine encephalitis yesterday. The New York State Department of Health declared EEE, as it's commonly known, Triple E, as a, quote, imminent threat to public health. There's more information about Triple E at cdc.gov. We'll take a break, and when we come back, election 2024 coverage. Democrats are losing ground in Pennsylvania voter registrations. The party's advantage over Republicans is slimmer than at any point since 1998. We'll find out more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, there is something that most of us do all the time that we think makes us more efficient, but it doesn't.
It turns out the faster people switch attention, the greater is their stress.
For the vast majority of us, multitasking does not work. There are a few outliers.
We didn't believe they existed early on.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
2 years ago, Mark Molinaro's victory in New York's 19th congressional district helped Republicans take the majority in the House. This year, he's seeking re-election.
I've been working these last 2 years to kind of reset, voted for border security, received the endorsement of law enforcement in our communities, and I've been working locally and in Congress to drive down costs, both provide meaningful tax relief and make smart investments so that we can drive down costs.
Candidate interviews for New York's 19th starting tonight at 6 on the Local Edition.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and our election 2024 coverage continues. As you just heard, we'll start hearing from the candidates for New York's 19th with Mark Molinaro, the Republican incumbent, tonight. And tomorrow we'll hear from Josh Riley, the Democratic challenger. Today we're going to talk about voter registration in Pennsylvania, the crucial swing state. Despite a bump following Joe Biden's exit from the presidential race, Democrats in Pennsylvania are entering the home stretch of 2024's election with their weakest voter registration advantage compared with Republicans in recent decades. The party's raw registration numbers began to rise after Biden dropped out in late July. The trend is continuing, but simultaneously, the number of Republicans has increased even more quickly. Jason Dole spoke to Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA on the Local Edition last night about why the Democrats' overall share of voters is still declining.
Republicans have been trying to register a lot more voters this year. They've really been making a push, particularly a gentleman by the name of Scott Pressler has been very active registering Republicans around the state. But some of this is just, I'd say the majority of it really is just the continuation of the trend we've been seeing here in Pennsylvania for many years. Democrats, rather, they saw a huge voter registration bump during the Obama administration, his first election. But ever since then, they've been losing that as older voters get taken off the rolls, or maybe somebody who was really animated to vote in that 2008 election hasn't voted since, so they get removed from the rolls. So they've been slipping for a number of years, but they are reaching a new low this year.
How about these voter registration trends among independents in particular? What does that tell you?
Yeah, that has been part of the story that you can't really ignore here, is the rise of independent and third-party voters or unaffiliated voters. So when we say that the Democrats are losing ground, that doesn't necessarily mean that the Republicans are picking up that ground. Independents and unaffiliated and third-party voters have become a bigger part of the electorate than they were in the past. In 1998, which is as far back as we can get reliable data, they made up about 9% of the state's voters. And as of last week, they made up just a little bit under 16% of the state's voters. So that might not sound like a lot, but when the margin between the top two parties is only 3 or 5% or something like that, they might, you know, those couple of percentage points do matter.
Right. Now, you also mentioned that voter registration numbers can be a noisy metric. That's kind of the term that you use. Can you elaborate on that and talk about how that affects the ways that both parties are approaching voter engagement and turnout?
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, if there are 3.9 million registered Democrats in the state and 3.6 million Republicans, That doesn't mean necessarily that a Republican candidate is going to get that many votes or a Democrat candidate is going to get that many votes. You know, people don't show up to the polls, of course. People don't always vote their party affiliation. We saw a lot of switching of lines from Republican to Democrat in 2020. So, you know, just knowing how many voters each party has doesn't necessarily mean that's how the election is going to go. Far from it, really. But it is an indication of each party's strength going into November. And you've been seeing Democrats here in Pennsylvania, you know, particularly the top of the ticket candidates, doing voter outreach and trying to get more voters registered. And I think because they recognize this trend, they recognize that they're not as in as strong of a position as they were in 2020, and that they are going to have to make up some of that ground between now and October 21st.
When I first saw that you posted this article and saw the headline, I was a little bit surprised for a couple of anecdotal reasons. And one of those is that the Harris campaign is saying they have 36 coordinated offices in Pennsylvania, whereas a Trump team only has about three. So I thought, boy, with that much of a ground game advantage just in terms of personnel, their registration numbers should be way up.
Yeah, I think, like I said, just looking back to 2008, Democrats had even more voters than they have right now, which sounds obvious, but they had 300,000 more voters than the point we are at right now. I think at a certain point, you know, you just reach a ceiling of how many folks you can register. So it's kind of hard to go up from a certain point, and you're going to start, you know, your opponent has more room to shave off that advantage. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing right now.
Right. And so from your perspective, like overall, this is mainly the case of like this change is the Republicans stepping up their game.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the week over week data that we had in the story, we have a graph of it, and you can just very clearly see that Republicans are performing much more strongly every week, registering more voters. Even on Democrats' best weeks, Republicans are still beating them. They have been doing a much better job at outreach or registration or whatever strategy it is they're employing. It does seem to be working. Yeah, not anything that like stands right off the face to me. But like I said, there is a gentleman by the name of Scott Pressler, who's a influential Republican activist. And he has a organization that focuses on voter registration. And he has been heavily active in Pennsylvania. So I think that is definitely contributing to it.
I mean, the last thing I want to ask about is, I know you mentioned Philadelphia in this article. Just, can you tell us like what the significance is about what happens in Philly?
Yeah, well, Philadelphia is where most of Democrats' votes come from statewide. They have about, as of last week, 785,000 voters registered in the state. But that's actually down a lot since 2020. It's down about 71,000 voters. So even there, they still have some ground to make up if they want to get back up to their 2020 figures. When you think about Pennsylvania, this is a state that in 2016 swung for Trump by just about 40,000 votes, I believe. And in 2020, it was less than 90,000 for Biden. When you say we've lost 71,000 voters in the state's most Democrat-heavy district, those kind of numbers can make a difference.
Yeah, and when you start getting down to numbers that low, it really kind of reinforces that every vote counts, which brings us up to the next thing I want to ask you about. The last time you and I talked, it was after the highest court in Pennsylvania overturned a lower court's ruling and basically said, okay, you know what? You need to properly date the envelope that mail return ballots are returned in. I was wondering if you can update our listeners at all on that case. Any developments since we last spoke?
Yeah, definitely. There is never an off week with the courts this time of the year. Something is changing every single week. So at the last place we stood, it was just like you said, the Supreme Court had said that the lower court didn't have jurisdiction, because the folks looking to eliminate this dating requirement hadn't sued all 67 counties. They just sued our two largest. And they said that just adding the Secretary of State's name onto the case didn't give that lower court jurisdiction. So the folks, the ACLU and the people they were suing on behalf of, refiled in that lower court, joining all 67 counties instead of just the two. But that same day, the Republicans asked the Supreme Court if it could clarify its order because, you know, granted, the order that the Supreme Court came out with wasn't very clear on what it said. So the Republicans asked the court to clarify, hey, is this an acceptable move? Can they do that and it gives them jurisdiction? Or did you intend to dismiss this case outright because you only said that the decision was vacated? So just this past week, the Supreme Court clarified its ruling. They said, no, you can't just join all 67 counties. The lower court still doesn't have jurisdiction. And yes, we did intend to dismiss the case. So that's it on that one. That one is now dead in the water, reached its final breath. But the issue itself of whether or not mail ballots need to be dated might not be over. As we had mentioned, talking about this case, when the Supreme Court order came down, some of the judges who dissented said that the plaintiffs, or the court rather, should take it up under their King's Bench authority, which is a power they have to just take up cases from the lower courts or take up issues outright without the normal procedure that these things go through. So there's still a chance that the ACLU and the plaintiffs in that case could file a King's Bench petition with the court and ask them to take up the dating issue before November.
Is there any indication as to whether or not they will?
Well, we'd be reading tea leaves, but you know, if I had to take an educated guess, I would say it's pretty likely. Of course, I've been wrong before, so maybe it won't happen. But
I asked you about this just because I figured that might have happened since the last time we talked. So even if you're going for the King's Bench, time's ticking. And now from what you tell me, it sounds like, you know, King's Bench option for that issue. It kind of sounds like the Republicans were looking at that and said, hey, that sounds good. But then they went the King's Bench route for a totally different issue. What are they asking the court to do?
Yeah, that's right. Last week, we saw the introduction of a totally new case, which we haven't written about yet. We're waiting to see if the court takes it up, because it's discretionary if they use that power. But Republicans, specifically the state party and the national committee, they asked the court to exercise that power to answer the question of whether or not counties should be allowed to have a notice and cure process. And when we talk about having mail ballots with dating issues, a notice and cure process is the county reaching out to the voter and saying, hey, you forgot to date your ballot. Can you come down to the office and put a date on it? Otherwise, we're not going to be able to count it. That process is not outlined in Pennsylvania law, but the courts have held in the past that because it's not specifically prohibited under the law, counties can do it. But now Republicans are challenging that that status quo and asking the court to effectively end notice and cure all over the state. So that's a new case that we're going to be watching and seeing where it goes.
That would be some big news if that goes in their favor, because that would change, again, the way that local boards of elections count their votes.
Definitely. I mean, that would affect I saw one estimate from somebody intervening in the case that might be 10 to 30,000 ballots that we're talking about, which, you know, from what I've seen in past elections, that's probably a decent estimate.
Did the Republicans indicate why this is something that they don't want happening?
They feel that it is, like I said, it's not a legal process established by the law. They point to this Supreme Court case from 2020 that they feel prohibits it from taking place. And, you know, they frame it as an election integrity issue.
Well, there we go. So, like you say, it's this mad rush to election day, and it's never a dull week, and there's going to be even legal cases you got to look at from week to week. Bigger picture, anything else that you're looking at in the short term before we talk to you the next time?
Yeah, well, we're still paying attention to some other court cases. There's two out of the western part of the state. One on the first part of that notice and cure thing I had mentioned, whether or not counties have to notify voters of these mistakes. And then there's another one dealing with, if you make a mistake, can you go cast a provisional ballot at your polling place and have it counted? Those are still making their way through the appellate courts. And so we will let you know when we have a decision on those.
And that's Jason Dole speaking to Carter Walker of Vote Beat PA. And we will have him back when there are some decisions in those cases in Pennsylvania, because we're keeping you connected this election season. Tonight, we speak to Congressman Mark Molinaro, the representative for New York's 19th Congressional District. Tomorrow, we'll speak to Josh Riley, his Democratic challenger. And coming up Friday at 11, right after Radio Chatskill, we'll bring you the debate between Lou Ingracia and Paula Kay. They're vying to fill the seat in New York's 100th Assembly District that's been held by Aileen Gunther for decades. Listen to the Catskills News Talk Mid-Hudson News New York 100th Assembly District debate this Friday at 11 a.m. right here. We'll take a break, and when we come back, more than maps, insights from the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference. It's an excerpt from the CatsCast podcast. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we continue our election coverage, The Latino Factor, How We Vote, this time with three iconic journalists from our community talking about the Latino vote, John Quiñones, Maria Elena Salinas, and Paola Ramos. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. CatsCast is the Catskills podcast, a biweekly series featuring Catskills culture, history, sustainability, local interviews, literature, and the arts. The shows are hosted by Brett Berry and produced by Silver Hollow Audio in the heart of the Catskills. Today, we'll have an excerpt of the latest episode of More Than Maps, Insights from the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference. Brett Berry is joining us now with that preview. Hello, Brett.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
Good. So what is the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference?
This is a nonprofit organization that began about 100 years ago and maintains and supports trail networks throughout New Jersey and New York. More recently, 1990s, into the Catskills. So they maintain about 260 miles of trails in the Catskill Forest Preserve. So you would think that it's the DEC or New York State, but actually it's this independent organization that does a lot of that work.
And I mentioned that you produced the CatsCast podcast at Silver Hollow Audio, but you got out of the studio and went on a hike for this one.
Yeah. Really, this podcast is just a big excuse for me to get out and do fun things. But, we try to do pretty much every story out in the field and meet the interview where they are. And, that's what I really enjoy, is to incorporate natural sounds and spaces. So this show is an example of that, where we took a pretty short hike behind the Catskill Center in Mount Tremper, New York, where they have a few trails right there on the property. And this was actually a trail that was built by the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference, and is an example of sustainable trail building.
Cool. Let's listen. It's the CatsCast podcast today with Brett Berry interviewing Melissa Cassini, Senior Program Coordinator of the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference.
Thanks, Tim.
Catskills hikers are likely very familiar with those iconic waterproof, tear-resistant trail maps published for decades by the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference. You know the ones, six folding maps in a sealable plastic sleeve, illustrating every designated trail in the Catskill Park, unmaintained trails and woods roads, lean-tos and fire towers, waterfalls, viewpoints, parking areas. It's pretty much a hiking essential. But the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference is much more than just an expert cartographer. On today's CatsCast, we hike with Melissa Cassini, Senior Program Coordinator for the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference. And we set out on the Upper Ridge Trail, a half mile in and out. Perfect length for our interview about trails.
Melissa, if you want to just introduce yourself.
Sure. So I'm Melissa Cassini. I'm the Senior Program Coordinator for the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference. I cover from the New York, New Jersey border up to the Catskills on the west side of the Hudson, and then from Westchester County up to Taconic State Park on the east side of the Hudson.
Can you give me a bird's eye view of the organization?
We started out in 1920, and we started out as a bunch of different member organizations that were kind of all out maintaining trails just in a different way. And we all came together and decided that, you know, there should be some unison with how things are working. And so the Trail Conference originated, and we've been around since then, building, maintaining trails, protecting public land. In recent years, we've done a lot with invasive species. We have a conservation dog program, which is very cool. And they're out, like, sniffing invasive species and just helping us with that work.
Why New York and New Jersey? Is there a reason that it concentrates on those two states?
Where we really started out was in Harriman State Park. I think our big volunteer base and, like, the people who started our organization were based in New York City. So it just made sense. You know, it's the central area there. Once the organization started to grow, we started to spread out a little bit to more towards central New Jersey and spread our wings out a little bit in New York, working all the way up in the Catskills.
One of the things that immediately comes to mind, I think, for a lot of people with the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference is those iconic maps.
Yeah, absolutely. Our maps. I mean, that's how I found out about the Trail Conference, too. I started using our maps, not even knowing that there was, like, a whole bigger part to the organization. So, yeah, our maps are very popular. I know I'm a little biased because I work for the organization, but I personally think they're the best. I wish that we covered more area with them when I'm, like, if I'm up in the Adirondacks or out west somewhere, I find myself wishing that I had our maps. So they're definitely a really big part of our organization.
You know, now with apps and phones, there's still, I think, a lot of hikers who, if they only have one map in their bag, would you say that one's it?
Yeah, I would say if people have a paper map in our area, it's the Trail Conference map, which is great.
Tell me a little bit about how you guys interface with other entities and stakeholders, including such places as the DEC or DEP or any of the many organizations that are doing work in and around the Catskills, especially with trails and public lands.
Across New York and New Jersey, we work with about 200 individual park partners, up in the Catskills, DEC being the biggest. And everything that we do, you know, we are there to support our partners. So we do the work that they want us to do that's going to support their mission. So up here in the Catskills, that means building, maintaining trail, working on lean-tos, and just making sure that things are open and accessible for people to enjoy them.
Where does the support come from? Are you a nonprofit, or how does that work?
Yeah, so we are a nonprofit. Support comes from our private donors, comes from state, federal grants, a lot of different avenues that kind of bring everything together to allow us to do the work that we do.
How big is the organization, and how do you fit into that? I guess just to give a sense of the breadth of the organization.
So I think right now we have a staff of about 31 people that support about 2,000 volunteers working across 2,100 miles of trail. So for the amount of trail and the amount of volunteers that we have, we do have a pretty small staff. So a lot of our staff are wearing a lot of different hats. And we are also spread over a pretty wide geographical area. So we have staff all over the place, out and about with our volunteers.
Now, do you cover all the trails in the Catskills, all the public trails, or, you know, and if not, how do you determine what your domain is in terms of
right.
Maintenance and work?
So we cover just shy of 260 miles of trail in the Forest Preserve. We started maintaining trails in the Catskill Forest Preserve, I believe, in the 90s. And that number that we maintain has grown since then. So we primarily maintain... Oh, sorry, we're going uphill. So we primarily maintain trails that are open and accessible to the public. How we decide what trails to maintain is primarily up to our volunteers, because that's our staff, right? We support our volunteers. So If they see a need for maintenance on a trail and it's something that they feel like they can add to our network, we'll do that. You know, we'll have that discussion internally, and then we'll go to the DEC, the park partner. We'll talk to them about it. If they agree, we add it in, and then we take on maintenance from there. In the Catskills specifically, we have, over the past few years, really grown our bandwidth up here. So we have taken on a few additional miles. We have done a lot more work on, like, heavy maintenance of trails, heavy maintenance of lean-tos. We've started our Catskills trail crew, who are out doing, like, work that maybe a general maintainer can't do, as well as our lean-to crew that are out doing more, like, heavy construction stuff, rehabbing the lean-to so that they can last another 10 years or so until they're able to be replaced. Day-to-day is always different, and it's very dependent on the weather, the season. In the winter, I would say my day-to-day is definitely more, I'm at a desk, I'm at my computer, working on projects, proposals with volunteers, meeting with partners to discuss the last season and plans for the upcoming season. And then come summer, spring, it's more, you know, we're in the field, we're getting work done. And while I may not be out in the field every day doing the work that the volunteers are doing, I'm just like behind the scenes supporting them and the cool work that they get to do.
And the geographical region of the entire trail conference?
In New Jersey, we begin work in about Hunterdon County up to the New Jersey border. And I think in New Jersey, it's about 800 miles of trail that we maintain. And then across New York and New Jersey include those long distance trails. So the long path that goes from a subway stop in Manhattan with the goal of going all the way up to the Adirondacks, it's about 360 miles. And then we have the Appalachian Trail through New York and New Jersey and the Highlands Trail.
What a cool trailhead that is.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I mean, it's just such a cool way to connect people from the city with nature. Like, you can walk from the city, ideally up to the Adirondacks, once the trail is, like, complete and in its final form.
Can you tell me a little bit about the projects that you've been most involved with over the past season or two and what we could look for in the trails?
So, up in the Catskills, especially over the past few years, I have personally really enjoyed working with our Lean 2 crew. Eric Friedman, he is our volunteer crew leader for that crew. He has been a carpenter his whole life. He's been a maintainer for a lean-to for a very long time, saw that it needed work, and offered to do the work. From there, we grew the lean-to crew. And while Eric does a lot of the heavy lifting, you know, he's the expert carpenter. I'm behind the scenes just purchasing the lumber and getting the work plan together, things like that. I would say probably one of the projects that they've done that I've been most excited about was the project that they did last year at the two trout pond lean-tos in the Western Catskills. One of those lean-tos is ADA accessible. So that was a bigger project for us where we had to build an ADA accessible privy. And it just felt like a really awesome, like, milestone project. The crew had started up their first full season in 2022. And by 2023, they were doing this huge project with a lot of people coming out to help.
For the non-hikers or the less frequent hikers, can you explain the importance of lean-tos in the Catskills?
Yeah, so lean-tos provide just like a place, a shelter, with kind of a roof over your head to stay while you're out in the woods. Some of them are like really beautiful viewpoints. They provide like a bathroom in some situations, either a thunder box, which is essentially just a box on top of a hole where you go to the bathroom, or a privy that is more of an outhouse situation. And especially an ADA accessible privy allows for people who may not otherwise be able to enjoy these spaces to come out.
Who else is maintaining trails in this region?
So the Catskills 3500 Club, they do maintain a few trails through our organization. So they have a maintaining club that they will coordinate a work day, and then their hours get reported up to us. Hours that our volunteers send us are super important for purposes of like grants and just our funding. Aside from the 3500 Club, the Catskill Mountain Club also maintains a few trails.
And is New York State and DEC also maintaining, or is it they lean on you for that?
So I would say that they lean on us in most cases, but they also have their seasonal crews or their operations crew that will go out and remove blowdowns or or do like maybe bigger trail projects. They will also contract out professional trail crews like Tahawish Trails, who are working across the forest preserve, again, on like those heavy lift projects that maybe our crews don't have the capacity for, or just because there is a lot of work to be done in the Catskills and, you know, our volunteers can't handle all of it. So just to spread out that work a little bit.
So this is a really important state nonprofit partnership that is keeping Catskills Trails in great shape.
Yeah, our relationship with DEC is very important, and it stems back a long time. We also have relationship with the DEC outside of the Catskills. We maintain on a lot of DEC properties on the Shawangunk Ridge or out in the eastern part of the state. So definitely a big partnership for us. We maintain a lot on their property.
What else should people know about your organization and kind of resources or ways to get involved?
I mean, we have so many opportunities for people to get involved. No prior experience necessary in most cases. We have our Conservation Corps crews who are out across the Hudson Valley, who will often lead work trips in maybe building stone steps or those more like technical trail skills. We lead trail maintenance workshops for people who are interested in learning about trail maintenance. We lead a lot of ecological stewardship, invasive species opportunities for folks to learn about that realm of things. So lots of opportunity to get involved, whether it's just for a workshop or you want to commit to a more permanent volunteer role with us. You can reach out to find out about these opportunities by going to our website at nynjtc.org, or you can just shoot us an email at volunteer@nynjtc.org. If you don't see an opportunity up on the website that really interests you, just reach out. We can always find a spot for you.
What's your favorite part about this job?
My favorite part about this job is working with the volunteers, hearing their stories about how they got involved in this work, and just seeing how passionate they are for the work that we do and getting to support that passion. So again, I'm doing, you know, the less fun administrative tasks, and then they get to go out and do the really fun work. And just being able to make that happen is really rewarding, and just working for something that I'm passionate about. You know, I love trails. I love the Catskills. And so just being able to work towards that passion is really rewarding and really exciting.
Do you still hike for enjoyment outside of the job, or are there other things you enjoy doing in this area?
Yeah, I do still hike a lot outside of work. It is often hard to separate that work hike and a personal hike, but I think especially coming up to the Catskills, I find myself up here pretty frequently on my time when I have time off. Just kind of like taking in the sights and scenes without maybe analyzing the sustainability of a trail. Like, oh, is that stone step going to stay there a long time? Or like, does it look like it needs maintenance? Just being able to like take off the work glasses, put on my own personal glasses in a sense, and just enjoy like the flora and fauna of things rather than the nitpicky little trail things. Outside of hiking, I also really love paddling. I go up to the Adirondacks a lot to paddle. I bake, I garden, I definitely find ways to keep myself occupied that aren't always hiking.
CatsCast, the Catskills podcast, is a bi-weekly production of Silver Hollow Audio. Production intern, Olivia Sipple. Transcriptionist, Jerome Kozlowskis. I'm Brett Barry. Thanks for listening.
You can find Brett Barry's CatsCast podcast at catscast.com. KAATSCAST.com. You can hear this episode and all of the episodes there. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we've got Maggie Fitzpatrick here helping us move toward health and how to improve fitness with tech. This is Radio Catskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl, and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian.
It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It is Tuesday, and every Tuesday we check in with Maggie Fitzpatrick. She is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is called Moving Toward Health. And today's topic, improving your fitness with technology. Hello.
Hello.
So when you talk about technology, you're specifically in this article talking about those wearable tracking devices like a Fitbit or an Apple Watch.
Yes.
Yeah. So what is it about these that are good and some things that are not so good?
Yeah. Technology is, it has come so far. I mean, you can't escape it at this point, right? And when it comes to our health and fitness, there are plenty of different tools that we can use to help us gather data, right? And track some sorts of different statistics that might be helpful for us to know if we're making progress, if we're not making progress, right? But the one thing we want to note is that it's not going to solve your problem for you, right? Right. It's just a supplementary tool. Mm-hmm. So that's like the first thing that we want to think about when it comes to, you know, any sort of wearable technology.
And, you know, you talk about the concept of moving outside your scheduled workout. We've talked about that a lot here, about not just having to go to this one appointment every day or whenever that might be. And this is a good way of creating some unscheduled workout. What kinds of things that can tech help us do in that realm?
Yeah. So I love to use them for tracking my workouts, and we can talk about that too. But when it comes to the movement outside of our like scheduled, very intentional exercise, I really like using wearable technology. I personally have an Apple Watch. I also have an Oura Ring. And I love using those because it allows me to keep track of how much movement I am doing. It's objective, right? I'm not making a subjective judgment of saying, oh yeah, I moved a lot today and mm-hmm. maybe I didn't, right? Because I'm just remembering maybe one part of my day or something. And so I really like that because it helps me see my step count, right? Like how many steps I'm taking. I'm sure everyone has heard of, you know, the 10,000 step goal. Right?
Yeah.
Which is a really great benchmark where if you're reaching 10,000 steps per day, then you probably are spending a good amount of time moving throughout the day, right? So I really like to use my technology for that. And the other thing that I really like to use it for is that it'll give you reminders to stand up, right? If you've been sitting for long periods of time. And I like that because it's really easy to get sucked into doing something on your computer or watching TV or whatever sedentary activity that you're doing at the moment. And so I like that because it'll just give me like a little nudge and it'll say, hey, like time to stretch your legs or time to, you know, stand up for a minute. And then that gives me that pattern interrupt that I need to say, oh yeah, I should probably move around, right? And then it's easy to get up and do that.
I mean, I'm aware of the whole step thing, right? But another thing that some of these smart devices can do is help you with your heart rate and just making sure you're monitoring cardiovascular, right?
Yeah, a lot of them are really great at tracking that now. And it allows you to keep track of your heart rate during your workout, which is important, especially if you are trying to stay within certain ranges, or maybe you want to push your heart rate because you know, want to train hard that day, or maybe you don't want to push your heart rate for whatever reason that could be. It's really helpful to be able to keep track of those things. And it also, you know, when it comes to heart rate and things like that, that allows you to see how you are performing differently day to day or how you are making progress over time, right? Because for example, with heart rate, let's just think about cardio as an example. Let's say you're running, right? If you can do a run that feels hard, right? And your heart rate, gets really high while you're doing that run. And then over time, you do the same run, but your heart rate comes down a little bit. That means you're getting more trained, right? Like you're doing better with your exercise. So that's a cool little like piece of information that you can use to see if you're making progress or not over time. And it'll also just help you stay within certain ranges for whatever type of workout you're trying to do at that moment too.
Are we still tracking calories? Is that something that we're also still doing? I know that there's been, you know, back and forth in a lot of different health journals and things like that, but calories still important.
Yeah. So this is kind of like the red flag piece of data, right? And a lot of these pieces of technology will track your calorie burn for you, right? Like both of mine do. And what we want to note here is that it's not bad to track calories. You can do that. It's totally fine. I like to look at it. It gives me another, you know, piece of info of how much I moved that day. But what we want to note is that it's not going to be 100% accurate for the number that it's showing you. So like if it says you burned 300 calories, it doesn't necessarily mean it was 300. But let's say today you burned 300 and yesterday you burned 200 and you are the same person wearing the same piece of technology. You definitely burned more on that 300 day than the 200 day. But it doesn't mean that it's 300 and 200. Does that make sense?
Like, is it more of just a range?
Exactly. Like, we can't get wrapped up in the exact number. Because mm-hmm. it's not accurate enough mm-hmm. to know, oh, I burned 374 calories, right? But if I burned 374, that's more than the 250 the day before, right? So we want to just take it with a grain of salt and use it more of a range and a comparison against ourselves versus a comparison against the number, if that makes sense.
But only a grain of salt, because you don't want that much sodium in your diet. No, but I guess the point is, yes, you want to make sure you can track it, but like you know, down to the exact number. If you're really tracking it that heavily, then we need to calm down.
We don't want to get fixated
right.
on the number.
But these things can be helpful, motivating exactly. as well. Right?
Very motivating, very helpful. And yeah, it's just we want to make sure we're balancing the fixation around the numbers, because that can lead us down a spiral that it can become very unhealthy. And that's not what we want for anyone, right? And it does happen. So if you are there, whether it comes to, you know, the number of calories burned that your watch is showing you, or even the number on a scale, right? Even, you know, a scale just to weigh yourself. If you're there and you're really fixated on the number, it happens, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we want to make sure that we're taking steps to detach from that in a healthy way. And the best way to do that would be to find some sort of help, you know, a professional to help you do that.
But again, back to your main point that the technology can help and is meant to be motivating, but it's not a quick fix to all of the things that folks might be going through as they're trying to move toward health.
Yes. Just because you get a watch or a Fitbit doesn't mean you're going to do the thing. Right. So every time, you know, I feel like at the end of every article, the message is the same, but you still have to choose to do it. Right.
Right.
So it's not going to tell you did anything if you don't actually do it. So, but yeah, it's great to have that visual, right, and to have those numbers and to have that piece of motivation to help you along the way.
You mean AI is not going to instantly make me lose weight?
Oh my gosh, that'd be amazing.
Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is Moving Toward Health. She joins us every day, every Tuesday to talk about it. What day is it? Tuesday. And you can also read the column at SC Democrat Online or pick up the Democrat. Thanks, Maggie.
Thank you.
All right. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Again, a reminder that we are keeping you connected this election season. We will be speaking to Congressman Mark Molinaro tonight on the local edition. Tomorrow, we'll hear from his challenger, Democrat Josh Riley. And Friday at 11, we'll bring you the debate between Lou Ingrassi and Paula Kay. They're vying to fill New York's 100th Assembly District seat, currently held by Aileen Gunther, who is retiring. Listen to the Catskills News Talk, Mid-Hudson News, New York 100th Assembly District debate this Friday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean and how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
People talk about polarization, but did you know most of us are in the hopeful majority, tired of political divisions and looking for a way out? That's why Radio Catskill and StoryCorps invite you to have a conversation with someone different and not so different than you. It's one small step where strangers get to know each other as people. Help bridge the divide, one conversation at a time. Sign up at wjffradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station helps are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, mostly cloudy, some showers around tonight. Today's high, 61, the low tonight, 52. Some of those showers lingering tomorrow through tomorrow evening. Tomorrow's high, 59, only down to 55 tomorrow night. Looking sunny for Friday through the weekend. It's 11 o'clock.